Welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast and our Week in Sports Cars episode presented to you by the Justice Brothers, presented to you by Cooper Tires, and also presented to you by DailySportsCar.com's Graham Goodwin. How are you this fine evening in the United Kingdom?
It's dark. It's been a horrible day here. High winds through the last couple of days, but it's great to be back with the Week in Sports Cars and happy to be doing it from home. It seems to be not very often to do that, MP.
Before we get rolling with the questions, I want to mention something really cool that is taking place next week. This is all being made possible by our dear friends at Mazda and also the Lemons of Love organization, which I'll mention them in detail here in just a moment. But for the third year in a row, the Lemons of Love folks, they're offering everyone a chance to win a factory-built race car. The winning ticket holder is going to take home the 200th Mazda Global MX-5 Cup car that is being built by the good folks, Tom Long's family organization here. And this is all as part of the 501c3 nonprofit raffle being done by Lemons of Love. So it's $100. The tickets are $100 to be entered into the raffle, and the participants, you do have a chance to win. It's a $68,000 vehicle, complete turnkey car as well. It's the, call it the modern generation Mazda Miata race car. Mazda Motorsports Director John Doonan will be the person pulling the winning ticket Saturday at Sebring, so a little over a week away. During the 12 hours of Sebring, and so this is something that I really love and support. We are obviously very grateful to our supporters, that being you as well. Tend to shy away from saying, here's something that you might consider doing that costs you money, but I mention this because this is actually pretty darn cool people. All donations from this raffle to win the 200th Mazda Global MX-5 Cup car does go to the Lemons of Love, and what they do, and we've actually received one of these, they create, fill, and deliver care packages for those who are fighting cancer and undergoing cancer treatment, chemotherapy, radiation, and whatnot. They've been doing this since 2014, and they've actually distributed a little over 9,500 packages to all 50 states here in the U.S. and 14 countries abroad. So on a family front, some of you may know that my wife, we're in the midst of this fight. Things are going well, super well. But yes, just out of nowhere, actually, it's courtesy of our friends at Mazda suggesting that the great folks at Lemons of Love send a little care package to Mrs. Pruitt. It showed up unexpectedly. And just tell you, for folks going through this, especially your loved one, could be your wife, sister, mother, whomever it is, it's pretty amazing just to have something like this show up that has a lot of things that one would need and want, might not even know about, some personal care items and such while you're going through chemotherapy. So anyways, this is just something that matters to me in terms of supporting an organization like Lemons of Love. So I appreciate you letting me take a little moment here to bend your ear and just mention that if you are interested, $100 for the raffle tickets, and you can visit lemonsoflove.org to register. And someone, I would actually enter it, but my wife would be mad because I already have a race car, and I haven't done anything with it for about 8 or 9 years, so she probably wouldn't let me have another one even if I won it. But a $68,000 Mazda MX-5 Cup car sitting here waiting for someone who hopefully for the price of $100 is going to get the bargain of a lifetime. So go ahead and check out lemonsoflove.org if it interests you. And with all that said, let's get rolling with the Week in Sports Cars.
We are going to be very aggressive with minding our approximate 90-minute time limit. We did have two openings to the 2019 season last weekend, that being the Blancpain GT World Challenge America Series at Circuit of the Americas. We also had the Trans Am Series kick off its season at Sebring. Mm. And between those two events and questions that we have received and other questions that have come in via social media, our Week in Sports Car show is 100% listener-driven. all via the awesome things that come in from Facebook, from Twitter, and also Reddit. So where shall we start? You are the one that we look to every week, Mr. Goodwin, to choose the categories between the different series. Where should we start this adventure?
Oh, the pressure, the crushing pressure. Let's go for him, sir. Let's do that. It's a surprisingly lean number of questions this week for the Omsian Society. I strongly suspect that next week with Sebring, it might take a bit of a spike because, of course, we're expecting the entry lists for the Sebring races in the next few hours, and I'm sure there will be things to discuss there. But let's go with IMSA. Do you want me to kick one off and throw one your way? Pitch one your way?
Lob those my way.
Right, well, let's go with Brett Somerson from Facebook. Good evening, Brett. With GTLM possibly seeing a significant drop in entries, he thinks Ford and BMW, would it make sense for IMSA to drop GTLM, go full GT3, Pro and Pro-Am subclasses? He knows the big issue is Corvette, but does IMSA have to follow the SRO exactly? Could they allow a Corvette IMSA special in? And doing so allow all the other GT3 manufacturers who cannot or do not want to meet the minimum build criteria a place to race? That's a pertinent question right now.
It's a great one, Brett. And the answer, I believe, is yes. I'm positive they will need to consider this, knowing that of their two GT classes in the WeatherTech Sports Car Championship, one is indeed licensed and sanctioned, I guess from an overarching standpoint, by the ACO and FIA with GTLM, and the second is just, as you've mentioned here, licensed and sanctioned globally by the SRO with the GT3-based GT Daytona class. And granted, if you lose Ford and BMW, as you mentioned, something we've spoken about a number of times recently on the show, we would still, in theory, have Corvette. We would, in theory, still hopefully have Porsche. We know that there is at least one privateer Ferrari with Risi that we don't know how often we'll see it again for the rest of the year, but we could have four, maybe five entries, so would not be a complete collapse of the class. But drawing back to your main point, is it something where if GTLM, Graham, is something where it's just more or less two manufacturers fighting one another for a year or two, who knows, maybe longer, there might be something to this. There might be something to this concept of going all SRO-based GT3 as IMSA's GT solution. If we just look elsewhere in the WeatherTech Championship, we have DPI, which uses ACO, FIA homologated and call it originated LMP2 chassis that are modified to manufacturer specs. So that's a little bit of a hybrid thing. ACO and FIA do not police that in any way. But on the LMP2 side, 100% controlled by the French in terms of rules and regulations. IMSA there, though, is branched out a little bit recently, Graham, by adding a little bit of weight, manipulating RPM to the spec Gibson V8. So just mentioning those, Brett, because we've seen that there have been even some distancing from the ACO and FIA to a degree in ways that suit America and America alone. So it wouldn't surprise me if this is a consideration that's been thrown around. And if we do get to a place where GTLM is cut in half in terms of entries, it might be something for them to take very seriously. Last thing I'll mention, since you threw in Corvette as maybe the outlier, there was a time where when they were one of the lions of GT1 racing in the America Le Mans mm-hmm. series, I could not envision a time when they were not involved in GT1. When GT1 started to collapse, they hung around for a couple of years. The thing that surprised me, maybe I shouldn't have been surprised, but they did end up building a GT2 car because that's where all the manufacturers had moved. I just never thought big, crazy, ballsy Corvette would be built to this second-tier GT standard, but indeed they did, and it was a great thing. So I would just say that there's at least a little bit of history, Brett, in Corvette adapting as the fortunes of the class they compete in happen to change. I don't know if they would be stoked about doing a GT3 car, but I can say that we've at least seen they've been willing to move if a class is on the verge of going away.
I'll add this, and it's not our tradition with weekend sports cars for us to both answer the same question. It's a very live question about a number of things. One is GTLM and GTE Pro, which manufacturers go, which manufacturers stay, of course, in the WEC. There's a little more body armor in that you've actually got a two-car Ferrari team, factory-backed, and you've got the Aston Martins as well. I believe there is potential to see an additional make added to the IMSA WeatherTech Sports Car Championship, possibly in a year or so's time. In addition to that, there's the separate kind of line of inquiry, which is around the homologation for GT3. And again, Brett, you mentioned that there's this production level that is going to be required for the homologation now, which is 10 cars to be produced in the first year of homologation and a total of 20 by the end of the second year. That is beginning to become a real thing for a number of manufacturers that are active internationally in GT3. It is a story we are tracking. I am fully aware that at least one manufacturer is already coming up with a plan B, that they are anticipating not being involved in GT3 racing, at least with their current product, in the relatively near future. So watch this space. I think we're about to see transformational point in international sports car racing. What is going to happen with DPI Mark II? What is going to happen with LMP1 moving forward? And what is going to happen either as a result or by itself on its own auspices to GT racing, certainly in the GTE, GTLM stakes? I think we've got one hell of a year ahead, and I think you and I are going to be pounding those keyboards, MP, with many thousands of words on these things.
I'm just proposing we go to GTLMP1. Class, truly, we've just wiped out multi-class sports car racing worldwide. There's just one thing. Hey, DTM, go get yourself a GTLMP1. Hey, Super GT in Japan, same thing. Hey, World Challenge. Anyways, I kid, but at the same time, there's a part of me that would love such a thing, because I hope I'm not the only one. I hope I'm not only among the listeners who struggles to just keep track of the 1,000 different classes and subclasses. And here's TCA, TCA Sprint X, TCB, TCBY. No, wait a minute. That's a yogurt shop. Anyways, I get lost in this stuff. But where shall we venture next, my friend?
Well, we're going to go to talk to friend to the show and the friend of the Marshall Pruitt podcast. Question about one of those, and it comes from Matt Needit, Facebook, who says, congratulations to Christina Nielsen for earning a seat as a second silver driver for the Endurance Cup rounds of the IMSA WeatherTech Sports Car Championship. Do you expect we'll see Catherine Legg and Christina Nielsen for the sprint rounds as well? Based on comments from the team about wanting to be taken seriously and not as a gimmick, smart money would be on Christina driving a full season. Why not just make that announcement now? I know a vague back injury explanation was provided for Jackie's absence, but I'm not counting on here behind the wheel of the 57. He's still waiting to hear when Alessandro Bolzan will return after his medical procedure last year. Can I add a quick bit here,
please,
before?
Please.
I have spoken to Christina and very recently, and I can tell you there will be other announcements to come from Christina Nielsen, but not what you're expecting. So it may very well be that the reason why you might not see Christina in the sprint races is because she's busy elsewhere. So watch this space on that one. But I don't know what else you can tell us about your ramblings around Heinrich Racing efforts after their disappointment last week, and good news for Christina. And I think it's fair to say that both you and I knew this was coming, but it's good news to have that confirmed.
Yeah, the Catherine Legg, Christina Nielsen angle for the Enduro rounds, the remainder of the Enduro rounds, not a surprise, we had expected that to be coming. Was hoping to see Christina confirmed for the rest of the year, period, in the car. But as you mentioned, there's some more news coming. We hope to hear that could even be with a different team for some of the rounds where she's not with the Meyer Shank Heinrich entry. Excuse me. I do believe we're going to see Jackie continue to test, continue to develop herself. The back injury thing you mentioned, I wasn't there. I can't speak to it in terms of authenticity. I just know that from a desire standpoint, Jackie is at a place where she is starting her driving career at a point after most, we would say, professionals have retired. Mm-hmm. So her learning curve is very long to be able to, you know, not just be on track, but to compete and to be, you know, in a place where she can be comfortable and the other drivers can be comfortable around her. So, again, speaking nothing negatively towards her, I would be in the same exact position, Graham. Mm. If I had the means to go GTD racing, I would. And it would also take me many years to get myself into a position to hopefully be on track and not get screamed at by all the drivers that I know and currently interview saying, Pruitt, seriously, take off the helmet. Here's a notepad. Here's a pen. Don't ever come out here again. Jackie, you know, I might have as much racing experience as Jackie. And granted, this is going back 20 plus years ago, but she's just has a minimal amount of mileage. And when that is also met with high ambition, you know, it's not a surprise when there's ambition to do something and then a realization, okay, this is going to take a little bit longer. So not trying to dance around anything here. I don't honestly know if she had a back injury or not. I just know that if she were to spend the year testing constantly to try and see if she can be ready later in the year for an appearance somewhere, then I think that'd be great. Also knowing that their Daytona did not start as strongly as they had hoped, Graham, this might be the better or best answer. Knowing that they did not have the results that they wanted at Daytona, I believe Catherine struck pit wall, leaving pit lane, and they lost a fair amount of time. If they're going to want to be in the championship hunt, we obviously know they want to be. They were in pretty much all last year with Catherine in the car. They're going to have to come back at Sebring and the next couple of rounds and really put in some strong performances. So if I'm just playing team manager, I'd be telling Jackie, look, you're awesome, you're amazing, and we can't wait to get you in the car. But if we need to deliver the best possible championship finishing position, plugging you into the car right now is not going to help us get to that point. So that's what I would be suggesting.
Final thing I'll add on this one, by the way, and it's a really quick one, is if you are a fan, and because you're listening to us, we know you are, we know you're passionate, and you are at Sebring, find Jackie Heinricher, and the thing you need to do as a fan is go and thank her for her efforts in bringing that effort to IMSA, because without people like Jackie Heinricher, you wouldn't have that car in the competitive form that it is. It simply would not be an effort that existed. So do that thing. Let's not concentrate on whether Jackie is quick or Jackie is hurt. The reality is that car's there because Jackie got off her rear and actually did some really solid hard work and made that happen. That's what's important. Next up, and this is from In the Pits News. Oh dear, it's had a rival. Hey ho, hello, from the USCR group on Reddit. And this is one I think you can add a little bit to here, MP. How much time do you think it will be until the Ford Ganassi DPI gets up to pace next season? There's an assumption.
Well, are we talking about race conditions or testing conditions? Funnily enough, dear listeners, this was an offline conversation Graham and I were having before we started recording. So I'll just wait to provide a deeper, what we both think is an insight, next week in a written piece. I did an interview with one person, good Lord, it's probably 2-3 weeks ago, might have even been a month ago. I've just been sitting on a little bit evergreen, just waiting for Sebring to get here so it lines up with a racing event. But hope to offer some insights on the Ford GT program, the Ford DPI program we definitely think and believe we're going to be seeing here in the near future. It vacillates, it fluctuates, it constipates, maybe. It could even be doing that. So if you are a frequent listener to the Week in Sports Cars, you will know that we have been like a sine wave. It has been, oh, it's happening. No, well, we heard the thing. It's done. Dead as a doornail. Oh, paying its back. Oh, it's definitely. Well, maybe. There's a definitely maybe. I'm not sure. Probably, but no, with the side order of, of late, we've been yes for sure, because those are the things we've been hearing from people that we know not to ignore. And, you know, again, we'll just say that we've been convinced. Heard some things even more recently, possibly within the last, I don't know, 48 hours or something, 72, that has us in the, all right, we kind of had this in first gear. Maybe we're getting ready to shift a second on the, it's coming in 2020. I've mentioned that in recent weeks, and I don't know, I can't say whether what I'm going to write next week is going to have me kicking that sucker into neutral or downshifting it to first. Maybe even upshifting it to third. Neutral sounds about right, but it's only Wednesday, March the 6th, which means when I get to St. Petersburg this weekend and speak with some folks who are in and around the Ford program, or get to Sebring on Monday, it could change. So I wish I could say concrete, this is the answer. Yeah, this is a meandering, wandering target, and I apologize for the constipation reference.
Perfectly fine. I'm going to just say this. There's a three-letter acronym that relates to the internet that comes to mind here. WWW. What, whether, and when. And all of those questions are still to be answered in relation to Ford. Do not make any assumptions at this point about any of those subheadings, what, whether, and when we might see from the Ford camp. Right, and following up from that...
Which is a nice way of saying disregard everything we might have said in recent weeks. But
it's worth saying, MP, that genuinely this is one of those stories that has gone from fair weather to foul, right back again, and then somewhere in the middle. It is an extraordinary tale of how motorsports, how difficult motorsports strategic planning is at the moment in the modern era motor industry. This is what it's like right now. It is, what are we going to do? Is it relevant? Is it affordable? You know, what is the platform? Has that got stability? Has it got profit potential? Has it ROI? All of those things. It is massively difficult. And I think we're going to see more of this, because the thing that's happening more than anything else is those decisions are definitely being taken later. It was a part of a conversation I had with Jens Markert at Bathurst from BMW, saying that, you know, when we hear about reviews and it all seems shock, horror, gasp, maybe, it's that the biggest change for people in positions like him is that the decision-making process has become more compressed and is phenomenally later than it used to be. And that adds maybe a little bit of excitement, but it also adds drama, not of a good sort. Potentially linked into that previous question comes this from our good friend Right Turn Lever from Twitter. And he asks a very simple question. Will there be a Twisk live session during Sebring?
Twisk, for those of you who are relatively new listeners, that is the acronym, the little hashtag for the Weekend Sports Car Show. Although show is not included in that, that'd be Twisks. But yes, the Weekend Sports Cars. We are planning on one. Our right turn loving friend actually lines up, as you mentioned, quite nicely. We hope and think it will be with our friends at Ford Chip Ganassi Racing, knowing that they are represented at Sebring in both the FIA WEC and IMSA's WeatherTech Championship. So, reached out to the team, I don't know, week or two ago, Graham. You and I were batting around, hey, we're going to be there. They're going to have both championships. Let's see if we can do something fun. So, had a couple ideas, reached out to Ford. They got back first and said, love the idea. We're going to try and make it happen. And so I'm just waiting to hear back. So we think it will. The issue, obviously, and the reason that we can't say it is happening for sure, it's on this date at this time, is since we have WEC on track on Wednesday, IMSA on track on Thursday, 1,500 miles of WEC racing on Friday, and then 12 hours of IMSA on Saturday. Friday and Saturday aren't good, for sure. Thursday is super important for one series. Wednesday is super important for the other. Nobody, I think, fan-wise, is really going to be there on Wednesday because Sebring fans traditionally filter in
yep.
for the first time on Thursday. So Wednesday is out. It means we're hoping to hear back something in relation to Thursday. It might just be, instead of at a, hey, we're going to be at Victory Lane or we're going to be at this organized thing, it might just be a little bit grassroots, do it yourself, turn up to the Ford Chip Ganassi Transporter, probably the IMSA one, if they park it where it's usually been parked in recent years, and just kind of do it there. So as soon as I hear back, provided we get the thumbs up, that could be fun. That's a lot of drivers. And again, based on what we think we know or don't know, or who knows, this might be the last time we see the factory Ford GTs racing at Sebring. It might not, but we figured let's try and do something big. And so we're certainly going to have news next week when we record the Week in Sports Cars live while we're at Sebring on Wednesday. And hopefully the timing isn't too short, because we're going to try and let you know beforehand if it's going to happen. And last thing to mention, in anticipation of it coming together, I've asked my friend, the awesome Roger Warwick, to start thinking on a little event promotional poster or something, a social media tune. And I won't mention the concept I suggested, but if everything comes together, I might actually have to make some posters of this one, because I think it'd be pretty cool. So
excellent.
There we go.
Right, we're going to crack on, and we're going to move on to our good friends at WEC Aslamis Elmzako, the WEC, Asia Le Mans Series, ELMS, and, of course, all things under the ACO regulations. And that is my phone kicking in, because it thinks I'm talking to Siri again.
Well, maybe you are. What did it think you asked it? And I'm going to keep this in. I'm not editing this out, because this is the kind of fun stuff that happens.
It apparently thinks that... I don't even remember. Did I say Pierre Fion?
No, but that would be...
I said ACO. It thought I said Pierre Fion.
Well...
How bizarre is that? How very bizarre.
Have you somehow trained Siri to hear the voices in your head? Because maybe you were thinking Pierre, and it reacted.
I think about him all the time.
There we go. I did note that Joel Nans asked about, I apologize for missing this, Joel, in IMSA asked about good vantage points for shooting at Sebring.
Apologies.
No. The answer is yes.
Yes, it did.
I'm not trying to be cheeky, Joel, but yes, if provided you're inside, because although there are a couple of external shots you might be able to shoot, but not really super conducive for quality photography, provided you are inside the facility, yes, they're everywhere. And I'm not kidding, just about everywhere is a good place to shoot and available. So, just plan on walking, because the more you walk, the more cool vantage points you will find. And yeah, inside Green Park, lots of great stuff. If you're looking for, hey, where should I go at what session kind of thing, because that it will change based on where the sun happens to be or blah, blah, blah. Just shoot me a note on Twitter or Facebook or DM me or something, and I'll try and help you out. But yeah, Sebring's just one of those places, Joel, where, you know, it's, what, 17 turns, and, you know, in some tracks you go, all right, don't even bother going to half of them because they're a waste of time. Sebring's one of those things where, yeah, you're going to find something almost everywhere, so it kind of makes recommendations super easy.
And here's the good news, of course, about a packed Sebring, whether or not it's the IMSA cars or the WEC cars on track, there's going to be world-class sports cars on track for much of that week. So wherever you are and whenever that is, there's going to be something worth pointing a camera at.
So now it's my turn to play Asker of Questiones. So we are going to venture into your world of specialty, as you mentioned, WEC Aslam, Elmzako. So let's kick off with a little bit of McLaren, Zach Brown, their relationship with the ACO in the wake of Zach's team, United Auto Sports, getting getting jobbered over receiving a single entry for Le Mans. This comes in from Alex Eichmiller. Alex, thank you for always sending in great stuff. He says, McLaren's been rumored to enter just about everything over the past year. Will United Autosports getting only one entry for Le Mans have any impact on Zach Brown's priority? Alex goes on to say, I understand McLaren and United are separate companies, but this seems ripe for conflict of interest. What do you think? If you were in charge of United, would the ACO's decision have any impact on your priorities?
Well, it's not going to help his humour, I'll say that much. But as for the business of United Autosport, it is completely and entirely separate. Let's say just that. As for Zach and his decision-making process for Le Mans, as far as United Autosports is concerned, is completely predicated by how many entries they're given, and they were looking for two, they got just the one. As for what McLaren will do, well, let's start with what they won't do. They came very, 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 very close to confirming a GTE car and associated program. In fact, just about exactly a year ago at the Geneva Motor Show, that did not happen. It did not happen for internal business reasons that they decided, I believe, at that point they wanted to look very much more closely at the LMP1 hypercar regulations. Whatever's said at the moment, I do not expect McLaren to be early adopters, very early adopters of those regulations. And I think you need look no further than the current state of McLaren's Formula One program to determine why that would be. Ask yourself the question. McLaren is a powerhouse. There's no doubt about that. But if you've got a company with the heritage that they've got in Formula One, would you as a board be funding and approving a second potentially distracting program to take away any kind of engineering management strength from what is already a struggling Formula One program? For that reason, and that reason only, I do not expect McLaren to be very early adopters of those regulations. Should you start to see signs of life in Formula One, then you've got an increasing scale of probability. But whatever Zach is saying publicly, I'm not buying it. I'll be honest with you. As far as the hypercar thing is concerned, for year one, certainly the regulations, I can understand why I'd want to keep the pot boiling. But at this stage, I think all of the concentration is going to be on Formula One.
Beautiful. Let's go to Edward and Emma Beresford inquiring about Algarve and their unique use of Judd propulsion in the Asian Le Mans series. I noticed that Algarve Pro does happen to use a Judd engine. Shouldn't all P2s use a Gibson engine, or is the Asian Le Mans series regulated differently than WEC, ELMS, etc.?
It is.
Personally, I'd love to see a variety of engines in P2.
Yeah, I think other than the fact I do love the Gibson V8, I think it's a cracking piece of kit, the 4.2 GK 4228. But yes, it is a different set of regulations this year, or the season we've just had, still runs to the previous LMP2 regulations. So you've got Nissan engine cars in LMP2 in Asia and three Judd engine cars. Both of the Algarve Pro cars had the Judd engine, as did the Panos Bartes Ligier. So they are at the moment, for reasons of affordability and to try to attract new blood into the cars. Those older cars will continue for the next season, 2019-2020, but only in the LMP2 AM class. The newer 2017 Gibson engine cars will be introduced in Asia in the Asia Le Mans series for the first time in 2019-2020. So that's why you're seeing that. And by the way, the reason why Algarve Pro were using the Judd engine is because their data said it was the better choice. They thought that was actually going to be the quicker package. And looking at the race results this season, you'd have to say that they were probably right, that they had potentially the less strong driver lineup with a full amateur driver in the car for two of those races. But they had some cracking results and were not being challenged for outright speed by the Nissan engine cars from United Autosport. So good spot, absolutely spot on. But yes, they're still using the older cars.
We're going to go to Holger Opelt. If this is the first time you've sent in a question, Holger, thank you. And if it's not, then I apologize for missing the previous instances. Bit of a, I don't want to say fantasy question, but a question we can't answer, but let's try, regarding lap times for DPI at Le Mans. Not sure if it's fun or serious, I know it'll never happen, but if you can imagine a complete failure of the new hypercar regulations for whatever reason, and the ACO decided to introduce DPI as its new LMP1 class, what lap times would we expect in Le Mans? Holger also goes on to say, with the current BOP of IMSA, for example, and the 2018 LMP2 pole time at Le Mans, 3:24.8 lap, it's only 5.5 seconds behind the fastest non-hybrid P1 car as a reference. Says, I'd assume a 3:21 might be absolutely possible for a DPI. So could a DPI nowadays compete with an LMP1? Would be a nice thought.
It's a nice question, and actually it's beautifully weighted as well, because I think there are two things to consider here. Come to the time for a moment. In a moment, the DPIs are clearly designed for the tracks they're going to race at. Le Mans is a very, very different track. They certainly have power advantage over the LMP2 cars, but remember, the LMP2 cars are allowed to actually use a Le Mans only body kit, which does mean that that does add some considerable weight behind their lap times at that very unique circuit. And it would not, were these cars to, let's in a fantasy world say they came as invitational entries from IMSA, would they be allowed to run a Le Mans only body kit? We can only presume. In their current form, I genuinely don't know, MP, what they would top out at and how quickly they get there along the Mulsanne Strait, the Hunaudière at Le Mans. So would it be dramatically different between a full rich WEC spec LMP2 and a full rich Michelin shod DPI? I think it might be closer than at some circuits in the IMSA WeatherTech Sports Car Championship. Certainly in theory, if they were allowed to engineer those, particularly the engineering around the aero, as they would wish to do it, there would be some considerable difference. I don't think you're a million miles away with your estimation at 3:21 or even quicker. But the aero is the thing, without a shadow of a doubt. And as we saw, we did get an opportunity, by the way, not in LMP2, but in LMP1, to see what difference that could make in terms of lap time. And we saw that with the Ginetta last year. They did not have a Le Mans spec aero package for the race. They opted to go with the high downforce package the car was designed around. And what you saw there was the car was phenomenally quick, even with a down on power engine through the Porsche curves, but was just dog slow down the Mulsanne Strait. So aero is a massive part of the way in which any of the prototypes generate their lap times at the Le Mans 24 Hours. And I think it's a great open question. I am sure somebody out there has actually simulated those cars around the Le Mans circuit, and I'd be delighted to hear what results they're getting.
You mentioned the key point here. Although there are lower drag aero options that are present on DPIs, in particular, and I think almost exclusively for Daytona, I would not be willing to say that the current DPI manufacturers have gone so far as developing what we would consider a proper Le Mans aero package for their cars, something that is just truly meant to slice through the air as efficiently as possible, making only the bare minimum of downforce. They can get there or thereabouts with what they have today. But yeah, to your point, taking an existing Daytona spec DPI to Le Mans, it'd give us a good idea, but we know that if this fantasy scenario ever happened, you would probably have those manufacturers, even though they say they don't want to spend money, if it was a possibility of winning Le Mans, they would absolutely require the ability to build a dedicated Le Mans aero package so they could extract more speed. Let's go to Matt Hawkins. He says, with United Autosports, UA, good friends, so not a surprise, got a couple questions here. With UA not getting the entries they deserve through the auto entries, do you think we will see a reduction in the number of cars in ACO sanctioned series or events? Or do you think we will see them look to other series, maybe like Blancpain? And this is maybe the wider prediction, Graham, for the future. Do we think that this recent Le Mans entry list, I don't know if you want to call it a debacle, storm in a teacup, whatever it is, do we think this is something because of the displeasure of United Autosports and some of the others who spoke up would lead other teams to reconsider committing to ACO-based endurance racing as a result? Or do you think this is maybe placing too much weight on this entry list thing and it may not actually have, you know, sweeping future ramifications?
I don't think it's overly sweeping. I think I'll say this, and frankly, if Pierre Fion, who may be listening, either under my desk or else elsewhere, you know, were to ask me directly to my face, I'd say exactly the same to Pierre or to anybody else in the ACO. I think it was a massive error. I think it sent a very unfortunate message, in particular to teams, considering whether or not adding additional ACO rules series to their program might increase their chances. I do, however, here's the big balancing comment, think that what we've had this year is almost literally a perfect storm. What do I mean by that? We had a not dissimilar issue last season because of the, remember, 18-month super season, which added the massive benefit, the massive bonus, particularly to the Pro-Am teams, of a guarantee of two Le Mans 24-hour entries if you entered the WEC. That surprised the ACO. I told them they'd be wrong, but they were surprised by it, with a larger than expected GTE AM class in the FIWC. That has meant that, of course, more places for the Le Mans 24-hours entry than we've been used to have been sucked up by the WEC entry. Add into that the net effect of an increased number of privateer LMP1s in that super season, but a decreased number of factory LMP1 cars. And that means that the GTE Pro class becomes very important in terms of the commercial side of that race. It is the factory teams that spend money at the race. That's where the ACO generates a lot of its income, which means that if the factory teams then ask for additional cars, the reality is they're very much more likely to get it than they would have done in previous years. We've not seen this boost to the GTE Pro squads in very many previous years. Add into that as well that a higher proportion than normal have taken up the offers of an auto entry, and that over the last few years we've had more auto entries added to that total. Add all of that together and you're left with a frankly stupidly tiny number that are available to the not just IMSA, because of course there are teams interested outside of auto entries from coming from North America, but the Asian Le Mans series and a booming European Le Mans series. So what does that all mean for coming seasons? I think next year you will see that across the three series I've just mentioned, something like 10 additional entries available to distribute by the selection committee. Do I think in the meantime that has caused potential problems in terms of confidence levels in Europe and in Asia? I do. I genuinely do. I think that was pretty short-sighted. There was a really good, well thought out reason for what they did. They wanted to get as many individual teams in as possible to show loyalty towards teams that have come back and back and back. And I admire that, but they just didn't have the wriggle room to do that sensibly. And for me, I'm really sorry. There have been occasions previously where you and I and others have actually said that just didn't seem the right decision. I think in this instance, it was a truly wrong decision. And I sincerely hope that doesn't have lasting effects on the confidence levels for teams wanting to add additional strings to their bow.
We're going to stay on this topic because I think we can more or less round up we've got two questions here. We've got two more on this topic. We've decided to keep these in, not because there's a drum to keep beating, but again, we, while you and I have many opinions and share them freely, this show is driven by you, dear listeners. So when you are sending these items in, if we're getting multiple questions, often variances on the same topic, it just tells us that it's really important to you. So rather than pare it down to one good one, we want to bring in some of the different shades vibes or angles. This one comes in from Ed Joris on Facebook. He says, do you think that most of the ACO's issues, many of which you and I spoke about last week on the show, come down to the organization having a, quote, tin ear, or is it just the French language, such as it is, has no word for transparency? Let me add just maybe the non-European answer. I believe I have a great relationship with Gerard Nouveau, with Pierre Fillon, lesser so. I mean, I just because I've spent less time with Pierre, but always had a very positive and solid interaction with him. If we look at Vincent Beaumanil, the technical director, he and I probably closest among the three. Big fan of them, big fan of the ACO and the WEC. We have many friends that aren't French that are within the organization, the great and amazing Fiona Miller, etc. A lot of great folks there. When it comes to this question that Ed is asking, an American asking a question about the French and wondering if they have a, quote, tin ear, something that's just a little thin and maybe not hearing either thin and being deaf to input that happens to be external or just deflecting those things altogether, there is certainly that perception here. And I cannot say with any authority as to whether it is a regional thing, whether we as Americans just look at the French and have some sort of natural assumption that this is just, quote, their nature. I'm not getting into that territory, nor do I believe that's where Ed's coming from. But I do know anecdotally, there is certainly a perception that maybe when it comes to listening to their constituents, might be more of a committee held within a closed room and at least giving the impression of not looking outward for input from the paddock, from could be media, could be fans, who knows what, but actual looking for outside input. Hey, we're thinking about doing this thing. How does it land with you? Positive, negative? Just give us some feedback so we aren't in an endless internal feedback loop. I can say that there is a common perception here that that might be the case today with the ACO and FIA, but I would also say that it might extend back more, you know, long before the WEC was created. So I can understand Ed's question. I can also understand why he might perceive things that way. And I can tell you that I think even coming out of last week's entry list thing, it felt the same to me. Okay. And again, I can't tell you if those feelings are because I am an American or what, but at least might be a thought process to offer from this side of the Atlantic.
Okay. I think all of that is perfectly fair. It's an impression. It's a view formed by available evidence.
And could it be completely wrong. But
let me offer you a different perspective and a little bit of insight. I have spoken to a couple of people who are involved, for instance, in the selection process. Also offer you a little bit of insight that you will be seeing some changes in the way, the structure of some of those ACO products in terms of the people are going to be involved in doing various things. Watch out for that. May or may not be transparent or announced, but there are moves happening to actually increase that feedback from the paddock. Let me give you an example. And it's when I was trying to kind of unpick why were those decisions taken, what were the good decisions, what were the bad decisions, and why, one of the ones that comes up, and I know it's our next question, so I'm going to roll in at this point the question we got from David Baker, which is talking about perhaps he's being a bit conspiratorial, knows nothing about the selection process, but is it possible that Mayor Shank was denied a spot at Le Mans because having two all-female teams shows you don't need a separate segregated series form in a W? In other words, could the decision have been made to preserve the justification from Fairfax Formula W? No, I don't think that had any part to play in it at all. It was when I was thinking about why that all-female crewed LMP2 didn't make the cut that you kind of, I tend to crunch the numbers in all sorts of ways to see if there's a pattern. And the thought occurred to me that with the exception of the WEC, which by right, you earn a position at Le Mans if you're a full season championship entry, the most successful series involved in entries, in gaining those entries, was the IMSA WeatherTech Sports Car Championship. 9 out of the 10 cars that applied, whether or not that's through auto entries, through the factory entries, or indeed the Meyer Shank car, were successful. That's pretty remarkable. And I have to tell you, if it were me, let's play that game for a moment, and I was the person responsible for making that decision, the Meyer Shank car would have been in, and I hate myself for saying it, because I love this team, but Rizzi Competizione would not be. And what we've heard since that decision, with Rizzi now deciding not to compete at Sebring, is exactly the reason why I'm saying that. The whole point behind the Le Mans 24 Hours is it should really be that celebration of the whole world of sports cars coming together. But part of the rule book says you've got to enter a full season of racing, either in an ACO series or in the IMSA WeatherTech Sports Car Championship. And the reality is Rizzi haven't. And that must mean that there are politics involved in that decision. And that's the part that I think most people find most difficult, is when the political side comes in, whether or not that be to do with balance of performance, equivalence of technology, or in this case, selection. I'll take another point on this one as well. Please do not assume that the people that are responsible for these decisions go in and do this with anything other than complete seriousness. I'll repeat again the point I made in answer to the previous question. It is very clear from the statements made by Pierre Fillon, who's the boss, he's the ACA president, that there was a specific point in making the decisions that they did. They were looking to reward loyalty. That had some unfortunate effects for some teams, including the teams that are at the very top of the reserve list. It had an unfortunate effect, for instance, for the Ginetta LMP1s, who are looking to recover from their disastrous start to that program with their chosen partner. But it had some good news for some of those smaller teams that, frankly, otherwise might have been in trouble next year for the commercial viability of their programs. What do I think next year? I think if Mike Shank and Jackie Heinricker come back next year with the same proposal, I think they're going to be going to Le Mans, is what I think. I think as well that most of the LMP2 cars that were unlucky this year will be going to Le Mans next year. It is not by any means a bad list for the 24 Hours of Le Mans. It's just not the list that you, I, or some of our listeners might reasonably have chosen. And I happen to think on this occasion that we may well be more correct than the ACO were on this occasion. That, though, is a highly unusual situation. I'll again say this. Over my entire professional lifetime, there has been a remarkable level of considered custody of what that race means. And the number of decisions that you could point to that were just dog wrong is tiny compared to the number of cars that have made up that grid over the last 10, 20, 30 years. I think in this instance, we've got to let this one play out. Do I think there's an agenda, anti-American agenda? 100% absolutely not the case.
No, not at all.
100%. Do I think that in this instance they have seduced themselves into a thought process that has led them to making a wrong decision? I genuinely do. But you know what? We're not going to know that until we find out what happens with the Asian Le Mans Series entry at the end of this year, and what happens with the European Le Mans Series entry, not for 2019 rather, but for 2020. I hope people keep the faith. I hope commercially they're able to keep the faith. And let's wait and see what actually happens while these things play out. But again, I'll say it, look at the numbers. Look at what we believe is going to happen in the season to come in terms of the way that the class system is going to go and the way that some of those bigger teams might be there or might not be there. And look what that means in terms of some of the teams that we're talking about here not going to Le Mans might mean for them next year.
You know, there's one thing that we might have added last week. I'll just throw it in now. And it doesn't mean anything, but I do think it's just an interesting thing to consider. knowing that there have been a number of questions like the second one that we received regarding the why'd they pick one female driver roster over another, bias, etc. What's going on there? Why one and not the other? Why not both, etc.? It is definitely worth mentioning that the Kessel Racing team, where the three women will be competing in GTE-AM, where they will be competing, that team won the auto invite, as you mentioned, as a result of capturing the GT championship, the GT3 championship in the Michelin Le Mans Cup last year. That championship, earned by Kessel in a Ferrari, was earned by two men, one named Sergio, the other one named Giacomo. Great for them. Yeah. So again, I mean, so there's, on the gender level, nothing to do with anything. Just pointing out here that Kessel won this auto invite based on the work of two drivers last year who aren't in this all-female entry. Again, no issue there. But what I just something to note that while there was a choice to be made by the ACO on saying, yes, we accept the drivers you have proposed, they are qualified, have the correct credentials to be in this automatic invite. Again, from a choice standpoint, the auto entry is already coming. Kessel could have, in theory, chosen any three-driver lineup. So just saying, while there's a, quote, choice to be made here, it wasn't so much one over the other. It was one's already guaranteed a spot, and that team's offered three drivers that we agree with. The other one truly was a choice, yes or no.
Yeah, but one thing I would say, though, Kessel have got two cars. So the reality is that Claudio Schiavone is going to be going to Le Mans in any case. I think that's that selection process was not a dissimilar one, with the added additional bonus, if you like, that it's an all-female team for Le Mans, on two or three counts. One is, it's Kessel Racing, an established powerhouse in GT racing in Europe, stepping up to GTE for the very first time, and stepping up with a two-car full-season ELMS entry. So again, proves the value of that auto entry through the Michelin Le Mans Cup. My belief, through the sources that I've been speaking to at Kessel, is that that will lead to them graduating to the FIWEC for the coming season. I think you will see at least one Kessel Ferrari for 2019-20. Possibly they may delay that until a second season in 2020-2021. But that is a team that has decided that GT is in their future. And on that front, putting aside absolutely everything else, that is just sensible husbandry of the ACO's ladder process.
Did you say animal husbandry?
No, that's sensible husbandry.
I know that's one of your previous jobs, so I'm just confirming.
My CV is long, yes. Varied, and distressing. But I think the answer here is, as an observer, as a commentator, as a fan, you can't have it every way. You can't have a situation where you can make a debating point that says it is absolutely correct for IMSA to go their own way with DPI and then ignore the fact that the other at times seem to be competing sanctioning body isn't going to be in a position to make sensible decisions about their own product. And I'm not saying that that's what you're doing or anybody else is individually doing, but it's just a balancing comment here that we do often see that kind of these moves seeing as being somehow blindly biased. Is there bias? Is there influence? Of course there is. But that influence and that bias and that strength that's given to certain factors is being done for completely sound reasons. It's often been my answer when I've debated with people in the industry, and particularly fans who stopped me in the paddock, or indeed we've had on Twisk before now, that when they ask me about DPI and Le Mans, which comes down to, okay, show me a list of factories that if they decided to say that DPI would be welcome at Le Mans, would commit those cars to the FIWEC. If you can show me that list, I'll be proportionately more convinced than I currently am. The reality is that list doesn't exist, and that's why the ACO are so dead set against it. When it comes down to it, it can be seen as being that's their rule book and not ours, and we don't like it, it wasn't made here. But they are perfectly entitled to support the product that they have invested very heavily in developing over the last 6 years. And I think that's not dramatically different from this. GTE is a massively important part of the ACO product, evidenced by the fact that we have 35 of those cars on the list for the Le Mans 24 Hours this year. They are looking to do what they can to support, prop up a class that, as we debated earlier in this show, might have its challenges ahead. Who's to say they're not right? We'll know in a year's time whether or not actually that emphasis was the correct one at this very important and slightly worrying time in terms of the way that that ladder is developing.
Got a question here from a frequent participant in the show whose last name just leads to your eternal befuddlement. Nick Dovbiniak, thank you for sending this in. Asks you, Mr. Goodwin, love the new logo, by the way. Thanks, Nick. He says, assuming McLaren have a good month of May, Indianapolis 500, and assuming McLaren decide to enter the hypercar world, is it more likely we'll see Carlin Racing running that program for them? I would think there are a number of reasons to keep United Autosports its own thing. Would that be something that falls under Zach's division? Or is it custom racing? Thanks again, you guys. The B is silent, by the way. Hope that helps. So I guess I have been incapable of pronouncing your last name correctly, Nick Dovniak. So there you go. We've almost, we've almost turned into the Zach Brown United Autosports episode here. So what do you think in terms of solution providers?
Right, okay. Would United be in the mix? I think they'd have to be in the mix. Might that be a conflict of interest? That's for the McLaren board to decide. Are there other teams involved at the moment in that debate? 100% there are teams and individuals involved in the process of determining what, if anything, happens for McLaren in LMP1/Carcar. And I'm not going to be giving you the identity of those teams. I can tell you, Carlin have not been mentioned to me in any regard. Carlin's entry into LMP2 is for one very specific reason right now, and that is their customer Jack Manchester looking to see what he can actually achieve in top line sports cars. Their future in LMP2 and elsewhere, I think, is going to be determined by the experiences they have in the LMS this season. But be assured, it is absolutely not a surefire thing. One, that McLaren will immediately move to Carcar, and if they do, that's program would be run, actually, by the way, not out of Garforth, because United Autosports are about to move mid-year to a brand new and rather larger facility, which is mainly to do with Zak Brown's historic car collection. No, there are other major players in the industry that are jostling for that program, should it ever come to be.
We are not, I want to say we're not mashing the gas here, not burning excessive amounts of petrol, but we will try and get through the rest here. We've got about a half hour left or so in the show, my friend.
Okay.
Let's get a topic regarding varying race length in the European Le Mans series. Comes in from ESPN WCYB on Reddit. That might be something I should pronounce as one word, but I'm not smart enough to figure it out yet. Who asks, the WEC finally made its calendar more diverse and moved from 6-hour races to a mix of 4-, 6-, and 8-hour events, plus, of course, the 24 hours of Le Mans. Are there any plans for spicing up the ELMS calendar a bit in a similar fashion? And what do you think about that idea?
It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, we're seeing some moves for what's coming in the Asia Le Mans series next year, not in terms of race length. We have had a 6-hour race last couple of years at Buriram, but the change that's going to be coming in Asia is we're going to be having a day-night race under the floodlights in Sepang. There isn't really that option for the European Le Mans series. I have heard no moves whatsoever towards a change from what has been a very successful 4-hour format for the LMS. And I would say to you this, really, look, we've got a record full season entry, 41 cars, capped at 41 cars indeed. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. I'll just add this in for debate. This is my suggestion, okay? I have suggested that they might consider That rather than actually having our final race of the season in Europe at Portimao, I do love going to Portimao, and Eduardo Fritz is going to hate me for this one, that maybe we might consider having it at Yas Marina under the lights. And that maybe they might consider in the future, if things are stable, that the following weekend we have the opening round of the Asia Le Mans Series at the same circuit with open testing in between. I think that would be a great way to finish one season. I think it'd be a great way to start another season. It does, of course, have some logistical challenges and some budgetary concerns that would have to be debated with the teams. But I'd love to see that considered and costed across the season. But no, at the moment, I'm not hearing that there's even a shadow of a debate about changing what I have to say has been a remarkably successful period and a remarkably successful formula for the European Le Mans Series. If you're not familiar with ELMS, I have to tell you, I think it's been amongst the best racing we've had over the last couple of years. That includes the IMSA WeatherTech Sports Car Championship, which is, you know, great to watch in a rather more kind of sprint format with the sub-3-hour races for IMSA. But ELMS, it's a cracker. It is one of those situations, MP, where you were talking a little earlier about the various ways in which we describe the same class of cars. One of the other things we tend to ignore, but we shouldn't, is the fact that there is this amazing mix of classes very often which are unique to the particular series. And of course, in the ELMS, we have the absolutely unique formula, which is LMP2 cars at the top class. There's going to be 18 of those. LMP3 cars, we'll have 14 of those. And then GTE rather than GT3 cars, as we see in the Asia Le Mans series. And that somehow just works in terms of pace, in terms of traffic, in terms of all those things coming together, and we always get drama. I've thoroughly enjoyed being part of the TV presentation for the LMS.
And we enjoy the fact that you are part of the TV presentation as well. Right, we're getting to the final WEC Aslam ACO bits here. Question regarding LMP1 non-hybrid BOP for Sebring. Coming in from Reddit's Worst Night, asking, why were the LMP1 privateers given a negative EOT, equivalence of technology adjustment for Sebring? It's not like they've beaten a classified, please write that down, it's another new word I've made up, a classified Toyota hybrid all season.
Well, I think the answer here is I'm going to give up talking about EOT and why they've done this and that and the other. And what I'm going to do on day one at Sebring is hunt down the technical delegate and get them to actually explain it to me rather than me having to do hard maths I'm ill-equipped to do. There will be a reason. It will be to do with the configuration of the circuit. I'm sure of that. But I'm not going to offer that at this point. What I'm going to try to do is to actually get somebody to talk to us on tape about EOT. And bring you that as part of a future inside the sports car paddock. I think that would be the right thing to do. You know, regular listeners to the show.
On tape, you say, by the way.
On tape. Well, let's call it digital. there you go. But regular listeners will know that one of my bugbears has been there's been a shortage of explanation and of clarity and of just transparency, a word that someone used earlier in the show, about these processes. There are going to be good reasons behind them, but if you don't offer those good reasons, people will join the dots often in new and exciting ways. So let's see what we can do to get the good people that are responsible for these fiercely difficult calculations to explain exactly what they're trying to achieve. My guess, and it is only a guess, is that you will find that they will make that explanation. They'll go, yeah, well, actually, that makes sense. Whether or not that makes sense in terms of the performance you're seeing on track is an entirely different question. But let's see what we can do to try to get some transparency out of that process.
All righty. Let's go to a little bit of ACO, maybe being less focused on road cars, possibly coming from Pasta Fazul. Says, Graham, I enjoy your broadcast of the latest Asian Le Mans Series events. See, look at that. You got fans. He says, your cartoon character for our show doesn't do you justice. Really? I thought it makes you look better, but it does the same for me, so there you go. All kidding aside, is the ACL looking to decrease GT participation at their events? It appears they're headed that way. The history of sports car racing is road cars. That's an interesting one. Not sure I fully understand it, but that's like many things in my life.
I think it's the opposite. I think they are keen to bolster GTE if they possibly can. It's a challenge at the moment. And again, a subject we've covered on the show in the past, MP, is that we don't yet really know what shape GTE might have in the future. If let's look forward and hope that Car and Hypercar is a success. I think it's got its challenges at the moment. But if it is, we've already debated repeatedly that might have a negative effect on factories prepared to support a GTE program as well. Could, rather oddly, the future of GTE be with the more niche manufacturers? Oddly enough, in the process at the moment of writing up some stories for Daily Sports Car on the back of some exciting cars we've seen revealed at the Geneva show this year, one of which is the third iteration under the Valkyrie program of a mid-engined hypercar from Aston Martin, which we know, if their car program comes forward, is likely to be the basis of a hypercar. This is the 003 version from Valkyrie. In fact, so we've got the Valkyrie, AMR Pro, and the 003 car. The second one is the brand new Ginetta Akula hypercar, supercar, 600 horsepower, in-house designed and built V8s in a front mid-engined package. Looks to me, when you look at that car, you kind of think, and particularly knowing Lawrence Tomlinson's history as a Le Mans class winner with the Panos Esperanti in not that distant past, 2006, that looks to me to have racing written all over it. Now, where might that race? Would that be a GT3? Well, it absolutely would not be. Could it be the basis of a GTE car? Well, that could be interesting, couldn't it? And I do wonder whether or not, you know, with Brabham showing interest in GTE Pro for the future, and perhaps with Ginetta looking towards a racing future for that package as well, whether or not there might be a tweak or several to the GTE regulations to attract the smaller manufacturers and get them onto that ladder. I know there's been acknowledgement from the ACO and the FIA that they feel they've made mistakes in perhaps not encouraging smaller manufacturers to look in their direction. Maybe that could be part of the solution in the future.
Future solutions to answers coming in 3, 2, 1. This is regarding Don Panos and the Garage 56 entry coming from BHTOOEFR. I'm not even going to try. I'm wondering if that's Dutch or Belgian. I have no idea. So there was an interesting tidbit hiding in the Le Mans entry list announcement regarding Garage 56. In it, they implied that that had Don Panos not passed away, he would have been a Garage 56 entry, but instead that project was suspended. I have to assume the entry would have been the Green 4U GT, the all-electric prototype they're looking to build. How far along was that project, and are there any signs of being resumed for, let's say, a 2020 Le Mans entry?
I think Stephen Kilby wrote about this some little while ago. I have to say I was surprised to see that little snippet. You're absolutely right, by the way. There was indeed a hint that was the case. I'm just not sure where that come from. I think that was parked sometime before Don's passing. It was certainly a brave concept. This was the concept where you've got effectively it was an offset single seater design with a removable and exchangeable battery pack. That was the idea to kind of keep a car running at something like racing pace with something like sensible pit stop times. But interesting concept. But I thought that had been parked sometime before we lost the good doctor. But, you know, I could well be wrong, but I'm pretty certain that we wrote about that sometime before, wrote about that being suspended, if you like, sometime before news broke that we'd lost Don Panos.
Yeah, and I had heard even before then that this really was not going to happen. So it was maybe it was just a nice way of honoring the doctor in words, yeah. At least on the entry list side. I'm positive that something will be done at the event to pay tribute to him. But yeah, even if the good doctor was still with us, I don't believe the Green for You EV prototype was really ever going to materialize, despite the initial bullishness that it was going to contain all kinds of revolutionary things, at least in competition to do so. All right, we're down to the last two questions in Weck, Aslam, Aco. And, you know, this is something that we've discussed before, and it never gets tiresome for me, regarding should the ACO get rid of auto entries for Le Mans. This comes in from our good pal, Mr. Baxter. It says, I find it interesting that the huge number of entries for Le Mans is being considered a problem. Seems to me like a good problem to have, especially compared to 2 years ago with just a two-car reserve list. That said, the UA kerfuffle seems to suggest that the ACO wants to have its cake and eat it too with the auto entries. So, should the ACO get rid of the automatic entry system to let them play politics with invites, or should they keep auto invites and stop playing politics? I wonder how you might answer that. Curious. Well, that, never know. But,
well, number one, the year, you're absolutely right, Andrew, and good evening, that there was the list where we had just two reserves. I can tell you for certain that at least one of those reserves hadn't really applied for the race. So that, I think, was a little bit of a backside covering exercise. And you're equally right that it is great to have a healthy number of cars, teams applying this year, 75 applied for the 60 available places. Should they get rid of auto entries? No, they shouldn't, because it celebrates success. Does it need to be reviewed? I know they review it absolutely constantly. And as we've debated before on the week in sports cars, even some of the auto entries that attract the most external criticism, that when you examine the results of those, and the one that often gets that is this GT entry from the Michelin Le Mans Cup. This is the series that supports the European Le Mans series. That the GT winner, so it's GT3 class, the GT winner attracts a GTE AM or LMP2 entry for the Le Mans 24 Hours. That auto entry has had a 100% success rate since its introduction in persuading the teams that have been successful to transfer their efforts to GTE from GT3. 100%. Every single team has done it. One of those teams, TF Sports, has graduated to the FIWC this year and are still in contention for the title. EP Motors in the LMS with their Porsche 911 RSR. Kessel Racing, as we've talked about today, with two cars coming into the LMS and I believe heading towards the WEC as soon as they can possibly muster the finance and the customers to do that. So the answer is no, I wouldn't like to see that taken away. I think it's an entirely fair way to distribute entries on immediate merit. I celebrate the fact that the second place LMP2 car in ELMS will be rewarded for the first time for next year's race. I think that's, again, completely correct, particularly in a class where you've got 18 LMP2s. Lest we forget, by the way, the biggest top class in prototype racing worldwide now, the LMS. That includes the WEC and it includes IMSA as well. More cars in their top class than anyone else anywhere in the world in prototype racing. So, no, I don't want them to withdraw those. Do I think it needs constant review? Yes, I do. Am I aware that they do constantly review it? They absolutely do. I have regular conversations with a number of people involved in just about all the series involved, and they confirm that every year they've got to make their bid for the auto entries that they would like to actually be offering, and they are extremely valuable marketing bargaining chips with their customer teams. Make no mistake about that. The LMS is healthy right now because you can get to Le Mans as a result of doing that. And the vast majority of the teams from last year applied this year, and I expect the vast majority of teams for the coming year to apply for 2020. So, no, don't think you should get rid of them. Yes, think you should review them, and they do.
I will go ahead and take the last question here and then move us on to general. And I apologize in advance for making a very easy and dumb joke. Truavasaurus from the WC Reddit group asks, Will the LMP1 privateers have new tires for Sebring? I really hope so. It's a really long race. Trying to do 1,500 miles on old tires? I mean, I'm just saying, as a guy that used to kind of do this stuff, it'd be that would not be my choice. But the part you can answer, though, is or new tires for P1 non-hybrid slated for introduction possibly at Spa, Graham.
Quite possibly. I do need to catch up with our good friends at Michelin and find out whether or not we are going to see some changes. Regular listeners, again, will remember there was a session slated for, I want to say, Shanghai. It might have been Fuji, but we had poor weather and that wasn't happening. And that is all to do with basically verifying data and potential offer for the end of this season and the coming season for LMP1 privateers in the FIWC. Let's wait and see what we hear from Michelin, who are going to have a very, very busy Sebring.
Going to move us on to General, which I, for whatever reason, maybe having watched too many World War II movies, like to pronounce as Hegeneral, as if I am a bad German general in one of those movies. Let's see. I will start with one here from Luke Philippone, who says, "Hello, guys. Over the weekend, I noticed the Blancpain America series quietly announced that their season finale will be at Las Vegas Motor Speedway." Absolutely true. "Have they said anything more about the event? Do you have any idea on what layout they're planning to use? Please tell me that at least one of the races will be in the quarter-mile legends track on the trials." Thank you. Luke, if it isn't, I'm not going. So I'm just making that clear right now. That's a great idea. I don't have insights yet as for the layout. We did speak with the SRO America's CEO, Greg Gill, during this week's Inside the Sports Car Paddock episode, and got some good insights. It might have not been during the interview itself that we posted, but I do know this will be going on, and it's probably not the hardcore details you're hoping for. It's that Las Vegas will represent for the series its 30th anniversary celebrations. So they are planning and going to invite all kinds of folks who've been part of World Challenge since it was founded in 1989. And so they are looking at their season finale as also the entire series rallying point to celebrate World Challenge. So I'm hoping to be able to head out there. That was actually my very first beat as a race car reporter in 2006, what was then the Speed World Challenge Series. And that, I guess, becoming my racing beat came after I was a team manager and quasi-entrant in the World Challenge GT category. Having participated, having been on pit lane, running a team, engineering cars, and actually helping Subaru factory effort to build a car that was a grand failure, that is significantly my fault, can say that, yeah, while my results as a competitor in the series were not always glorious, I do have deep and long-standing fondness for it. So if I can, I'm going to get out there, not just because it's the season finale and there's fun stuff to happen, but also due to the celebration. We're going to go to the next question here. This coming in from Ryan Terpstra, and thank you, Ryan, for always sending stuff in. I'll just mention this. If you do send in questions, and we do appreciate the questions, give us as much as you can in terms of what you'd like us to answer. Ryan's question, which is, what's the deal with the Nissans? Is it the car, the teams, the drivers, all the above?
Nissans?
Australian Supercars, Super GT, World Challenge, GT3, I don't know. I can tell you, GTP, maybe it's a retro question. And if you're quadruple awesome, Ryan. As for what's the deal with the Nissans, well, it's a Japanese brand, the lovely manufacturer. Read that Carlos Ghosn, he's out of jail right now.
He's got bail. Yeah,
that's good. We do have a dear friend in Paul Ryan, who does a lot of wonderful PR.
Never heard of Nismo.
Yes. So that in terms of deal topics, kind of what comes to mind. But yeah, kidding aside, if there's some deeper insights you're hoping for, Ryan, just give us a little bit of sense as to what series, and we might be able to help. Why don't you take the one if you want, Graham? Again, knowing that we're kind of down to the last 10 minutes or so, why don't you pick one or two from General, and then we'll move
I'll
to
do that.
Fun.
Well, let's go for Grimbrother 1 from the the Reddit WC group. One would imagine you both have to maintain a modicum of impartiality due to the nature of your work, but it's nearly impossible to enjoy this sport at its deepest levels and not have loyalties or deep-held affinity for particular brands. Great question. With that in mind, do you have any specific makes or models that will always garner your rooting interest? Can I answer that one quickly? It talks, this one, to me, MP, to... I know a drum that you've beaten a couple of times, which is that rather more Garage East type effort that you and I mourn the apparent death of in international motorsport. I love the plucky underdog. I've always loved the plucky underdog. And sometimes they may be crap. Sometimes they may not be ultimately competitive. But I love seeing these guys try. And a couple I'm going to name check certainly weren't crap and certainly were at times competitive, but were not... you know, across the piece, you know, always going to be up there and battling hard. TVR, bless them. Bless those cars. I have a deep affinity with that for one abiding reason, and it goes to the very start of Daily Sports Car. At the British GT Media Day, and we've just come back yesterday from this year's iteration, and so this is what, some 16, 17 years on from that, and chatting away to a couple of teams in what was then the Silverstone paddock. We were at Donington Park yesterday, and down the pit lane behind a quad bike is pulled the most orange car I have ever seen in my life. It was Dayglow Orange, a team called Eclipse Motorsport. And they had just lost their primary sponsor. We had just launched the world's most orange website. A deal was done between myself and one of the team co-owners. And that car for 2002, and I'm looking at a picture of it on my wall at the moment, became a fully Daily Sports Car liveried, effectively what you would now regard as being a GTE car. I love that car more than words can say. We had that that full livery for the full year. We had representation on that car for a further couple of seasons. And for me, TVR, it was just the plucky underdog. It irritated the hell out of the likes of Stefan Rattel, who, you know, was trying at that stage to kind of get the templating of GT racing together and look at the success he's made of it. But I just love the kind of British GT attitude, was just to come and bring something just a bit loop the loop. And we've, you know, what attracted to me that to that series in the first place, MP, was that you would go along and there'd be the quaff. You know, a GT1 car, the Quaife, the Ascari, you know, all sorts of bonkers GT race cars that you would see absolutely nowhere else on the planet. And planet, by the way, is another new word. But TVR for me, quite, I think, often despite themselves, with the T400R, with the Cerbera Speed 12, with the earlier Speed 12, just all kinds of absolutely awesome, at times awful, frustrating for the crews that actually have to maintain the things, but so many tales. There'll be a book written about it at some point. It might be me that writes it.
Let's get on to fun here. We are at our rough self-imposed 1.5 hour time
absolutely
limit for the episode. So we don't have that many funds. The first one from Jamie Bender, we kind of get that somewhat regularly of choosing driver road rotations and whatnot for a certain fantasy race, so we might give that one a little bit of a pause. Give us a little
next,
bit of
next
a gap
week, Jamie.
Next
week.
But where would you like to go for one or two funds?
Let's go to James Counter from Facebook. Stab at this. The ACO decided they can solve all the entry list problems by adopting the N24 rule of garage sharing. Great question.
Right,
who
James
would form the party garage? Who would be the best pranksters? Who would be the most horrified at having to share?
I mean, that to me is very easy.
Go.
Yeah, we they would have to. Who knows? Maybe actually we have just found the second independent customer for a Ford GT. Right now they have a Lamborghini Huracan GT3, which wouldn't be eligible. So we'd need to get them into an ACO-compliant vehicle. If we could get I'm just telling you, if we could get John Potter to buy a Ford GT and bring Magnus Racing to Le Mans, it not only would it be the party garage, it would actually be the garage that I think they would have to come up with their own, quote, entry list. They would have their own entry list problems for who would get to join them in that stacked team garage, because between Potter, between Andy Lally, I think you'd have to bring in Ryan Eversley as a driver as well. You'd have to, knowing that with their PR man, Sean Heckman, and their dinner with racers, they would have to absolutely not pay the ACO any of the money that they want for doing live streaming or broadcasting. They'd have to go full pirate and do the Magnus Racing live stream from Le Mans. I mean, this just has to happen. And if they would pay whatever fine that they might receive from whatever they would charge the other teams to be there, and trust me, they could probably subsidize the entire trip from teams wanting to be in that big, beautiful, hot mess of a garage.
I'm going to go a little bit further with that, because all the while you were saying that, that's a genius observation, by the way, live podcast for the Le Mans 24 Hours from the garage, shared between Magnus Racing and the Porsche factory team. Now that would be funny.
This with Mako, good old Larry Van Tours, and Nick Tandy just being his funny / incandescent with rage self, Earl Bamber just thoroughly unimpressed at everything while laughing at his teammates and so on. Yeah, this is
it's more than that, because it is this strange thing with Porsche. Okay. They've got an amazing bunch of guys involved at every single level, but there's a corporate side to it which somehow lacks that sense of fun. They've got, you know, they've got that that image, that brand, and it's fabulous, don't get me wrong. It brings something very special, but it also takes a little bit away. There is that building of a bit of a wall around it, and I just think a bit of mild but persistent teasing might lead to something pretty special there.
That, I think a live webcast shave Jimmy Bruni's head during the 24 Hours of Le Mans. I mean, look, we've already won the broadcast Emmy here, or the webcast Emmy. I'm not sure what it is. But anyways, that would be my suggestion. Let's see. Here's one. Let's close on this. And we've got a couple others that we'll skip for now. As we always mention, if we did not get your question and you'd really like it answered, please send it in again. We usually get to them second time around, sometimes third, but please don't think that if we did not get your question that you are being ignored. Just send them in again. We'll do our best. Let's go to our pal Shay Adam. Shay, who puts in a surprising amount of time thinking of these great, fun, and general questions that she fires in for us. Shay says, "It always is amusing to see drivers get to choose their own rental cars and what they come up with. What driver would you choose to torture with a year of driving only Fiat 500s, not even the Abarth version, or a tiny Kia Rios at every race they go to in 2019? I mean, you know,
if only what direction Bush do you was go? Still right.
Well, you know, that would actually be torturing the car, not him, unfortunately.
You know the answer to this question. Well, you know the answer
but
to
I'm
question.
Just thinking there's so many angles to go, so you have these
no, there's one angle. There's only
cars.
One angle, and there's only one man.
Okay.
There's only one man that you would belly laugh every time you saw him peeling himself out of a Fiat 500. You'd film it. It would go to the web. It would go viral. Stand up and be recognized, Juan Pablo Montoya.
Oh, my goodness. Well, yeah. And I am, trust me, the thought of he and I?
It'd have to be a convertible.
Well, you'd have to get out. You'd have, every time we'd get in, you'd have to first apply a stick of butter on both seats. So there was some sort of non-stick material to pull our fat butts out of there. I was thinking all 9'12" of Cooper McNeil. Now that would be funny. He would actually be sitting, he would either be sitting in the passenger seat and reaching across, or sitting in the back seat. He might have to request or just bring a ratchet and socket with him to remove the driver's seat at every round and just pilot the thing from the back seat, knowing that he is just a tall, tall hot mess of a driver. An awesome guy, but that would be funny. Seeing Coop trying to get around in a Fiat 500 all year long. But granted, I mean, you know, it's not like he couldn't afford something better. He might, knowing his connections, knowing that he races a Ferrari. You know, who knows what he could cook up with the Fiat group. They might be able to actually have the world's most expensive Fiat 500 if we weren't careful, and have those drop shipped in for him to drive that probably had a twin turbo V8 Ferrari stuffed in somewhere, and who knows what. He might add a mezzanine that he could, you know, sit in and drive from. Who knows? I love the idea, though, Shay. Who else, though? I mean, if it's Montoya, myself being just two hot dogs in a blanket, and please do not let that sink into your brain. That was a disgusting reference.
I'm going to add this, by the way. I was at Base Performance a couple of years ago, which is Darren Turner's simulator business, and Darren had bought an original Fiat 500. I think he's got rid of it now, but that looked a lot of fun. I'm going to add this. It's not another driver. It's my own car experience for the Sebring 12 hours of Sebring for some years ago, and it was the final year as the editor of Daily Sports Car for Malcolm Cracknell before he retired, and I think maybe the year after that Malcolm had been persuaded to come to Sebring, and I decided, okay, let's have a quick look what's available on the high car front, and did indeed find a deal, which was Chevy Camaro convertible or similar. Okay, it's those two words, isn't it? All similar. Turn up at Orlando Airport, pop along to whichever woeful bunch it was, probably Alamo, and was directed towards the row of cars that you can choose anyone you like, sir, along the multi-story car park parking garage, as I believe you guys say, contained this particular group. Off into the horizon were a sea, a veritable ocean, of Chrysler Pronto Cruiser convertibles in all over white. I checked, every single one was in white. Went back and said, no. Was directed to the next row, which was another ocean of Chrysler Pronto Cruisers in all over white, with the additional attraction of two VW Beetle convertibles, both in all over white, at which point I did go back to the representative and I said, 2 points, no, and hell no. That, as the standard operating procedure for the entire grid of the IMSA WeatherTech Sports Car Championship, or indeed the FIWC arriving at Sebring, I'd pay money to watch that parade, because there would be so many very, very embarrassed drivers.
I just want to see you recreate that rental car experience for yourself. That is all kinds of hilarious. I had a minivan once for Sebring, and the occupants involved every morning, one Samuel Steamship Collins, and also Woucher Mellison from his awesome website. That's the last time I believe I got a true speeding violation as well. So in Florida, bad. In a minivan, even worse. And I somehow was speeding in the dang thing with an Englishman and a Dutchman. I mean, this is,
it's like a barge, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. All right, my friend, well, this was the week in sports cars for a lovely Wednesday, March 6th. We're heading to St. Petersburg. I'm going to be there this weekend for the IndyCar season opener, which also has a World Challenge component. So that is cool. Staying over, driving down to Sebring Monday morning, and then we'll look forward to seeing you soon after, and we will record the week in sports cars next week while sitting next to one another for the second time this year. And Who knows what kind of questions we will have. Who knows if we can find a place that isn't going to drown us out, since the new media center is just a tent right behind the pits, which tends to be deafening. So if you hear the words that we speak, even better. If not, it might just be a live ambient audio feature that happens to be named The Week in Sports Cars. But with all that said, I'm Marshall Pruitt. That is Graham Goodwin. Thank you to Cooper Tires and the Justice Brothers for making this possible. And thank you, dear listeners, for giving us something that has become so darn much fun for us to record every week. We will see you in about a week from Sebring.